This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Jane Hill. Thanks for downloading the World Tonight podcast for Thursday, the 24th of October. The Chancellor says the UK needs more investment. And to find the money, she's going to change the way it measures its debt to allow her to borrow more. The Conservatives say she's fiddling the rules. We'll ask an economist what Rachel Reeves is proposing and what difference it could make. The UN says without action, the world could warm by a massive 3.1 degrees Celsius this century. We ask a climate scientist what can yet be done to reduce global emissions. And here, scabies is on the increase. We ask a doctor why and what we should be looking out for. The UK needs to spend more on infrastructure, says the Chancellor, and she's decided that can only be achieved by changing the self-imposed fiscal rules. Rachel Reeves says she's going to alter the way debt is measured, and that will allow the government to fund extra investment to the tune of billions of pounds. Less than a week from her first budget as Chancellor, she says she wants to bring jobs and growth to Britain. The Conservatives have accused her of fiddling the rules. We'll hear from them in a few minutes. First, though, let's just hear a little from the Chancellor. She's at the IMF meeting in Washington and has been talking to our economics editor, Faisal Islam.
I'll be setting out two fiscal rules next week at the budget. The first is the stability rule, that we will pay for day-to-day spending with tax receipts, and we will meet that within this parliament. That's something that the previous government never achieved, but it's really important for the sustainability of public finances. And the second rule is our investment rule, so that we can grow our economy and bring jobs and growth to Britain. And we will be changing the measure of debt. I'll set out the details of that to the House of Commons next week. But I've listened to the IMF, and I'm at the annual meetings this week, who have been clear that we do need to free up more money to invest in capital, as well as listening to people like Gus O'Donnell, Mark Carney, Andy Haldane and Jim O'Neill, who are all saying we need to invest more to grow our economy and seize the huge opportunities there are in digital, in tech, in life sciences, in clean energy. But we'll only be able to do that if we change the way that we measure debt.
So the credibility of these rules is really important for everybody, for the public, for the markets. Some might see this as a slightly sneaky shuffle when you're in a bit of a tight bind fiscally. Or are you embracing the idea that this is meant to, for example, maintain investment levels at 2.5%? Is that what you're trying to do?
The first rule, the stability rule, is the one that really binds and is hard to meet. And that will require difficult decisions on spending, welfare and taxation. But there's a choice then about whether we want to continue on this path of decline. And the plans that I've inherited from the Conservatives see public sector net investment decline quite rapidly as a share of our economy. And if we continued on that path, we would miss out on other opportunities and other countries would seize them. Well, I don't want those jobs and those investments going to other countries. I want to see them in Britain because we've got huge potential. But of course, it's important that every pound of taxpayers' money spent gets value for money and delivers a return for the taxpayer when you invest in big capital projects. So we will be putting in guardrails with the National Audit Office and the Office for Budget Responsibility, validating the investments that we're making to ensure we deliver that value for money and to give market its confidence that there are rules around the investments that we can make as a country.
The Chancellor speaking there in Washington. Well, let's talk through exactly what is proposed here. I'm joined by the Director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, Paul Johnson. First of all, very good evening to you.
Good evening.
What's your understanding of exactly what Rachel Reeves is proposing here?
Well, there's several things going on. What she's clearly suggesting is that she will borrow quite a lot more money. It sounds like a good £20 billion a year in order to invest in capital infrastructure and the way that she's making that fit with what appeared to be the same fiscal rules as the previous government is to change the definition of debt so that on the particular definition she'll choose, it will be going down, whereas on the definitions that we got used to, it won't be going down over the next several years. There's clearly a case for additional infrastructure spending, but she's choosing to pay for that by borrowing more rather than by raising that in additional taxation.
And how much money will that release, do you think?
Well, in principle, we don't know exactly what she's going to change about the debt definition, but it looks like she'll change it to a measure which in principle could release an enormous amount, £50 or £60 billion a year. In other words, this will not actually be a constraint on the amount that she can borrow for investment, because there is no world in which we assume that she will be able to or want to increase investment by that much. Now, that creates this sort of strange situation in which she was talking about putting guardrails up. In other words, this new rule simply won't bind, and she'll have to find other rules determining how much she can actually spend. And I think this is one of the things that may be worrying the markets a bit, which is that she's saying, well, look, I'm going to change the rule. This rule could allow me to borrow another £50-60 billion a year. That's more, by the way, than Liz Truss was proposing to borrow for her tax cuts. But I'm actually not going to make use of all of that. I'm going to find some other way of limiting what I'm going to be spending and some other way of showing that it's going to be value for money. Now, I'm sure there are ways of doing that. And as I say, I think there is a good case for additional spending on infrastructure for capital investment. But actually, we've heard so far no details about how that's going to be controlled or actually what it's going to be spent on.
And you mentioned the impact on the market so far. I mean, is there more that she could say, that she could explain in the budget next week, that actually might steady what nerves might possibly be there?
Well, I think what she'll probably do is just set out the amounts that she actually intends to spend on investment over this period. And if, for example, what she does is simply not implement the cuts that the previous Conservative government were intending to do, I don't think anyone's going to worry too much about that. If she says she's got a target of getting investment to, say, 3% of national income over a 5 or 10 year period, again, I don't think that's going to cause any great trouble. I mean, it's clearly the case that we need more infrastructure and capital investment in the economy. Of course, this is not a free lunch. It will mean that there's more debt. It will mean more debt interest spending in the long run. But as long as she's very clear about what the actual limit on this will be, as opposed to what in principle she could borrow within her newly created fiscal rules, I suspect that won't create too much trouble in the markets.
Paul Johnson, as ever, thanks so much for joining us tonight from the IFS. Let's get reaction from the Conservatives. I'm joined by the Shadow Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury, the Conservative MP Gareth Davis. A very good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Your thoughts about this?
I mean, the first thing is somewhat surprise. Before the general election, Rachel Reeves made it very clear that she wasn't going to increase debt. I thought that's what we all agreed on, that more debt was not a good thing. Debt is already very high. And in several interviews, she actually outlined that changing the debt rules would be, in her words, fiddling the figures. And so it is surprising that she's done this. But what's just as surprising is the way in which she's done this. We were in Parliament today. She's decided not to come to Parliament with this in the first instance, which is a major announcement, which is going to have profound impacts, not just on this generation, but future generations to come because of the level of debt. We expected her to come to Parliament to outline the detail. She's not done that. She's done that overseas.
But there may well be more detail to come in the budget next week. It's only a matter of days away. I mean, there's clearly more to come.
Well, we absolutely will look at the detail when it does come and when she comes back to Parliament to be scrutinised on this decision. Of course, we will engage in that. But as I say, the way you announce major fiscal announcements is to Parliament. Parliament is there to scrutinise our Chancellor of the Exchequer and to question the decisions that are being made, particularly when it's a decision that she said she wouldn't make before the election.
Well, This is what she's talking about today is purely about investment, though, isn't it? This is not about normal day-to-day spending. This is about investing in infrastructure. And there could be people listening to this thinking, actually, I'd like to see more money spent on hospitals, schools, prisons, public transport.
Well, absolutely. Overall, we want more investment into our economy. We want more investment into our, in our national infrastructure. Of course we do. That is what we agree on. We believe, however, that the principal way in which you can have sustainable investment into our infrastructure is through private investment and trying to garner private investment through both the taxation system, but also things through planning and other measures. The way you do not have sustainable infrastructure is to add to debt, which ultimately, in the end, will cost the taxpayer more, potentially through their mortgages with higher interest rates. And so this is a debate to have. But I thought we'd already had this debate before the election when Rachel Reeves said that this was not the way that she wanted to boost investment. She said she would not do this. She said she wouldn't add to the debt and fiddle the figures as she said before the election. So
but the Labour,
this is the debate we're having.
The Labour manifesto didn't talk about the definition of debt. I mean, it's not an election promise broken.
She's given plenty of interviews, and in the House of Commons, she's made it very clear, as I understand it. You know, just be clear with people. I think going into a general election and having a position on changing the fiscal rules is reasonable, but that's not what happened here. And that's why I think we are very surprised by this this decision today.
But there are economists backing her plan. She's listed a lot of them. It includes a former Tory minister, Lord O'Neill.
Well, of course, we will look at the detail of where this money is going. But as I've already laid out, we believe the way we boost investment into infrastructure in our country should be first and foremost about the private sector, private investors. We are second or third in the world when it comes to foreign direct investment. We introduced full expensing and other measures to attract investment into our country. That's the way in which we believe investment should be bolstered, not through adding debt to our country.
Gareth Davis, thanks so much for joining us tonight on The World Tonight. Thank you. Let's get the thoughts of our political editor, Chris Mason. He's at the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa. He's been interviewing the Prime Minister. Chris, we'll talk about that in a moment. But a lot happening in Washington, too. Your thoughts about what Rachel Reeves has been saying. What does it tell you, tell us about how she is preparing for that budget?
Yes, evening to you, Jane, from Samoa. Fascinating hearing the conversations that you've just been having. I think what we're seeing now rolling out in plain sight is the Chancellor and the Prime Minister setting out in advance of the budget what they're intending to do. Yes, if you like, as they would hope, to get some credit for it, because on the day itself you get this sort of deluge of budget news. But also they hope that they can reassure the markets that what they are doing is responsible. I think there's a keen awareness of what happened a couple of years ago with Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng. In fact, Mr. Kwarteng returned from that IMF meeting that Rachel Reeves is at to find that he was being sacked after the mini budget and all of that. So that attempt to not surprise both the wider electorate and the markets, given the change in those borrowing rules, I think is key here. And we should acknowledge that, yes, there's the political argument, as you were just reflecting there, but also a step change, and it's for a listener to come to a conclusion as to whether it's a good or a bad one, in terms of how a Labour government is approaching the national finances and how the previous Conservative one did.
More on that, of course, next week. Meanwhile, you're at Chogham, as we say. A huge issue there around reparations for transatlantic slavery. Tell us more about what the Prime Minister's been saying.
Yes, there's this club of 50-plus countries, most of whom have a history in the British Empire, small and large, poor and rich, scattered all over the world. And those countries, particularly in the Caribbean, feel that the UK and others ought to be doing more to acknowledge the impact of slavery and ultimately to pay for it. Now, the Prime Minister has made it clear that he doesn't think that that is right or justified. But I put to him in an interview I did in the last couple of hours here in Samoa that his Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, who's also here at this summit, said in opposition that Britain has never faced justice for the crime of slavery, as he put it. So I asked the Prime Minister, was he right?
I think we should be clear from the outset that the slave trade, slave practice was abhorrent. And it's very important that we start from that place. And of course, that matters hugely to many of the countries that are represented here. The question then is, where do we go from there? Now, my posture, if you like, is that we should be forward-looking, that we should look at what are today's challenges in this group of countries represented here today. And in the discussions I've already had before I came here and since I've been here, it's very clear to me that the major challenges are resilience in the face of climate challenges, and also the question of how we improve trade between our countries. And that's my posture, if you like, my focus is on the forward look, not the sort of backward look.
I want to understand the nature of your objection. Is it a financial one, or is it a moral, philosophical one? Can our generation be held responsible for the actions of our forebears?
Well, I think our generation can say the slave trade and practice was abhorrent, and we should. You know, we talk about our history, can't change our history.
Say that, but not apologise, not pay any money.
Well, look, you know, I think that, you know, we recognise that, and of course, apologies have already been made in relation to the slave trade, and that's not surprising, it's what you would expect. But if you then go on to the question, you know, we're 55 countries here represented, and say in the conversations I've already had, what are the things that have come up most? I can tell you their resilience. They're a real concern, particularly with some of the smaller countries, about the impact of climate on them.
The Prime Minister there speaking to our political editor, Chris Mason, who was talking to us from Samoa. And before we move away from politics, just to flag to you, as we've discussed before here on the programme, the government says it's making welfare reform an important part of its growth agenda. One area it wants to address is the growing number of people aged 16 to 64 who are economically inactive because of long-term sickness. The most recent ONS figure, which is for the last quarter of last year, is in fact 2.8 million. So looking ahead to the budget, we're interested in hearing from people who are in this situation. Whether you're out of work and having to live on benefits, or perhaps you run a business and you can't find the staff you need to keep your business going, do get in touch with us in the run-up to the budget. A reminder of the text number, 84844. We're on WhatsApp as well, 03700 100 444. And of course, trusty old email, world.tonight@bbc.co.uk, and full coverage of the budget next week, as you would expect. You're listening to The World Tonight. Just to give you a flavour of what's coming up later, it was one of the most notorious court cases in the US. Back in 1996, the brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez were convicted of murdering their parents at their home in California. Now, the LA County District Attorney has just announced that he's recommending the brothers are re-sentenced. We'll be live in California later in the programme for more on that. In just under 2 weeks' time, though, we should know who's going to be the next president of the United States. And you probably know the polls suggest the contest is finely balanced. But on some issues, Donald Trump, for the Republicans, appears to have pulled away from his Democratic rival Kamala Harris. Immigration is one of those issues, and it's one of the main concerns for voters. The World Tonight's James Menendez has been travelling from Mexico to the southern United States to find out what's behind the debate. He joins me now. Hello, James.
Hi, Jane. Thank you very much indeed. Yes, I'm in San Antonio in southern Texas, a part of the US that's really at the sharp end of the debate over immigration. From here, it's just a couple of hours' drive to the Mexican border, and you feel the influence everywhere. Many extended families are scattered on either side of the border. But it's the issue of illegal immigration that's come to dominate the campaign. A deliberate strategy, it seems, by Donald Trump and the Republicans, who've used slurs and false stories about migrants, eating pets, for example, to make it one of the top concerns for their supporters and many Democrats too. And if the polls are right, it is an issue that favours Mr. Trump. His Democratic opponent, Kamala Harris, has had to tack right to keep up, promising, for example, to further tighten security along the border. Well, we began our journey in the city of Monterrey in northern Mexico. At the Monarch Refuge, named after the famous migrating butterfly, a group of small children play in the gravel of the courtyard. Around them, a series of basic but clean dormitories housing about 100 people, drawn from all over Central and South America. What they have in common is that all of them want to get to the United States. For José Luis and Rosa Mariño, this is the first time for 6 months they and their three children have felt safe. They say they left Venezuela because of political repression and the dire state of the economy there, embarking on the long and often perilous journey towards the US-Mexico border.
We thought that the jungle was the hardest part, but when we got to Mexico, we saw it was even worse. Because if you are not running from the immigration police, you are paying the cartels to let you continue your journey north. Otherwise, they'll kidnap you or hurt you. What happened to us was that a guy told us he'd give us a lift. He said he'd take us in his car, but before we knew it, we were being held hostage at a farm. Then you have to pay. Otherwise, they won't let you go.
There are plenty of smugglers who take them across, but for them, it's a risk too far. Instead, they want to apply for asylum in the US. And finally, last week, they were given a date for their interview with the immigration authorities. It's in 2 weeks, but not at the border crossing near here. Instead, it's in Tijuana, across from San Diego, 3 hours away by plane. Another journey and another expense. But Rosa says it's worth it.
I know we're going to have to work hard, but at least there'll be opportunities, and it's a safe country where my children will be able to get a good education.
Others, though, are stuck in limbo. Sonia's from Honduras. She has two grown-up sons already in the US and two other younger children with her in Mexico. She's been waiting 10 months for her asylum interview. She tells me she doesn't want to wait any longer, even if that means crossing the border illegally. And this is the border that so many want to cross. I'm now on the US side in a city called Laredo, looking back into Mexico across the Rio Grande. But it's not very big at this point, maybe 40 or 50 metres across and fairly shallow by the looks of it, the birds just flitting in the reeds that line the riverbanks. The numbers trying to cross without the right papers are down in recent months, the result of a strict cap on asylum claims introduced by President Biden a few months ago. But many still do. More than 2,000 people were stopped by Border Patrol agents in August on this stretch alone. Others, though, do manage to slip through.
Okay, so we are in South Texas on my family's cattle ranch.
Stephanie Crisp Canales grew up on this farm, and now she and her husband Marcus run it. She's also head teacher at the local school. She says groups of undocumented migrants regularly trespass across their land, playing a dangerous game of cat and mouse with Border Patrol.
The majority of them come in through vehicles that they run through our fences, run through our gates, so that causes a lot of damage. We also have them that come in on foot. They leave trash behind. We run a cattle operation, so that's, you know, worrisome for our cattle. We don't want our cattle to eat the trash when it's cost us thousands of dollars.
And so what do you do when that happens?
Well, obviously, you know, we call the Border Patrol, and then we usually try to follow them. We try to stop them, because we don't want them on our property. Because a lot of them that are walking on property, they are the ones that cannot apply for asylum because they are the ones that have records from their country. So they're wanted for murder. They're wanted for rape.
And how do you know that? Do you know that for sure? I mean, they can't all be murderers, can they?
No, but, you know, because we've had several large groups here on our property that the Border Patrol have caught. And they will tell us, yeah, you know, this one's wanted for murder. We're like, oh, man, you know, I mean, that's really scary. When you live here and you see it every single day, it's not letting up. And I don't think it's going to until somebody gets an office that's going to truly, truly shut the border down.
And who is that, do you think? Is that Donald Trump?
I mean, right now, that's our only hope.
For those who manage to evade the Border Patrol, there is plenty of work in Texas, much of it in construction, to satisfy the growing demand for housing. Not that anyone will admit to deliberately employing undocumented workers. The state's Republican governor, Greg Abbott, wants local law enforcement to have the power to arrest and deport all those who cross illegally. But there would be a price to pay. Ed Berlanger is a house builder in San Antonio. He says he tries hard to ensure everything's above board, but sometimes that's not possible.
We hire, you know, companies that employ other people. We obviously work towards making everything as legal as possible, but from a builder standpoint, you know, we're hiring a contracting company or a subcontracting company or a supplier, and they hire folks. Nobody's checking their cards or anything like that to get them to work.
But if those undocumented migrants, if they weren't there, then the houses wouldn't get built, right? Or at least not as many.
Not as many and more slowly. And time is money, so the longer things take to do, the more expensive it is.
House builder Ed Berlanger there, ending that report from The World Tonight's James Menendez.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, here is a story I did not expect to be talking about when I came to work today. There has been a big rise in the number of cases of scabies. GPs have told the BBC they're seeing record numbers of the highly infectious skin condition, particularly in the north of England. The worst affected group are university students and people living in care homes. Medics say one of the problems with its spread is that many people are too embarrassed to talk about it. One student told the BBC what it was like.
It's like tiny red dots along your wrist or like go in between your fingers. One of my housemates came out to the house that she had scabies at the time as well. So then I was like, okay, so do I.
Well, goodness, let's talk to Dr. Tess McPherson, who's a consultant dermatologist from Oxford who specialises in adolescent dermatology. Dr. McPherson, a very good evening. Well, I'm glad we have you on. I mean, I have to confess, I had to look at the NHS website just to remind myself what scabies even is. I mean, what is going on here?
So I'm glad we're talking about it because clearly everyone needs to know what scabies is because it's always been with humans. There's evidence of it from as far back as 400 BC and it always will be with humans. Why we're seeing so much of it now and over the last few years isn't completely clear, but it's spread by skin-to-skin contact, not necessarily sex, but any skin-to-skin contact. So living in crowded accommodations, people sort of mixing more. So young people, students, particularly the beginning of the student year is a time when we see more scabies. And we've certainly been seeing increased and problematic increases over the last few years. And it seems ironic and really unfair that young people who had to take such a hit in COVID, now they are sort of contacting each other again and now having this big issue with scabies. And it's not a trivial problem because it can cause the symptoms can be so bad, the itch can be so bad, it can stop you sleeping. And as you mentioned, the shame and the stigma, which is totally unjustified and totally unhelpful, because it does mean that people don't seek help or don't get it diagnosed. And a lot of people don't even know what it is. So
yes,
it doesn't get recognised.
Yes. When we heard that young student saying, oh, I came out about having scabies, you think, my goodness, that's extraordinary. I mean, you've mentioned some of the things it can do there. Can it have a more serious impact? Can it have something, something further down the line?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say, you know, I think being really itchy, feeling really stigmatised and not sleeping are pretty serious impacts. But in terms of other health impacts, it certainly can cause skin infections. If you've got a condition like eczema, which is itself can be stigmatized, it can make that worse. It can cause sometimes systemic infections, rarely, and those are much more common in tropical countries. But I've seen young people sort of devastated, and their experience at college or university or work can be completely overcome by problematic scabies that they just don't seem to be able to get rid of.
Goodness. So crucially, your advice to someone listening who thinks they might be affected or they want to know how to avoid it.
Well, yeah, I mean, to a degree, you can't completely avoid humans, so you're not going to be able to completely avoid scabies. But if you are worried, if you're itchy, if other people are itchy, then get treatment and don't ignore it. Don't feel ashamed. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's not because you're dirty. It's really common. Not just you need treatment, but everyone in your vicinity is of what we call close contact. So that would be your sexual partners. And I've seen some of my patients that don't want to tell their partners they've got scabies, who by definition probably also have scabies. So one of the other things we're seeing is that it's very easy to get reinfested if everyone doesn't do the treatments at the same time in the correct way. And a lot of people probably don't use the treatments effectively. So that's the main thing, is to get the treatments, use them effectively, and make sure that everyone around you uses them at the same time, so you can try and sort of break the cycle of reinfestation.
Dr. Tess McPherson, excellent advice. Thank you so much. Really glad you could come on tonight. Thank you. Now, the world is teetering on a planetary tightrope. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was in no mood to sugarcoat the findings of the latest UN Environment Programme report, which is warning that global temperatures are on track to rise by 3.1 degrees above pre-industrial levels this century, way above what countries pledged at the Paris climate talks in 2015, which was to limit the increase well below 2 degrees, with an emphasis on sticking to 1.5. Responding to this report today, Antonio Guterres called for urgent action.
The message of today's emissions gap report is clear. We are teetering on a planetary tightrope. Either leaders bridge the emissions gap, or we plunge headlong into climate disaster, with the poorest and most vulnerable suffering the most. This report shows annual greenhouse gas emissions at an all-time high, rising 1.3% last year. They must fall 9% each year to 2030 to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the very worst of climate change.
Well, Professor Johann Rockström is director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. He gave me his reaction to the report.
It was no surprise, but it's deeply concerning. This confirms that we are still moving in the wrong direction along a very, very dangerous pathway that will take us in only 75 years to unmanageable conditions for the vast majority of people on planet Earth.
Who stands to suffer the most?
The evidence over the last 5-10 years have corrected a misunderstanding that we've lived with for a long time. We've thought that the climate crisis hits us sometime far in the future, and that it predominantly hits the vulnerable people in the global south. The most vulnerable in the global south are still the first victims, that's correct. But we see today, already at 1.25 degrees Celsius of warming, that it's hitting us across the entire world. We have floods in Germany, we have heat waves in Europe, we have fires in Canada, we have human reinforced hurricanes in the US, Milton and Helen. We have vast floods in India, and of course we have the tremendous disastrous droughts and food insecurity hitting vast parts of Africa and India. We are to a different extent causing this, but we're all victims to it.
Is it fair to say that it is G20 nations that should be absolutely leading the way here, because they're responsible for more than three quarters of the emissions?
Definitely G20. I would even narrow it down even further, that we have the four largest economic regions in the world. It is the US, it is China, it is the European Union together with the UK, and it's India. These four dominate the global economy, which means that if you get these four to decisively start acting in the right direction, for example, introducing a price of carbon of in the order of $200 per ton of carbon dioxide, that would automatically spill over across the entire world economy.
People listening to you will quite possibly despair. They will think, what can I do on my own? There is nothing I can do as an individual in the face of this. Are there technologies, for example, that you can point to that could actually have really decent impact? I'm thinking of solar, wind, areas of technical development that we should be urgently investing in?
The answer is yes. We have so much evidence today that we have scalable solutions. We see today that solar voltaics, wind farms, different types of biofuels, efforts of scaling different forms of thermal-based energy systems and hydropower systems can be scaled and outcompete gas, oil, and coal, particularly coal-based electricity, for example. So this is now not only exponentially increasing in the world, it's increasing in many, many markets across the world, and it's coming up to double-digit percentage points. So you have 10, 20, 30% of electricity provision in many markets in the world from green renewable energy. The dilemma right now is that the world is growing faster than our ability to phase out coal, oil, and gas. So far, green energy systems have largely only met growing demand of energy. They haven't enabled us to reduce coal, oil, and gas. And that is why we need to do, for example, what the UK has done to deploy and then invest in renewable energy systems and at the same time truly phase out coal. We still have a window that is open. It is rapidly closing, but it is still open. If we can phase out fossil fuels to a net zero world economy over the next 25, 30 years, we can still hold this door open, but it is rapidly closing, so we have to move extremely fast. And that is why this report is so important. It's time to truly act so that we can have a chance.
Professor Johan Rockström. Now, it was one of the most notorious court cases in the US back in 1996. Brothers Eric and Lyle Menendez were convicted of murdering their parents at their home in Beverly Hills. The crimes were recently the subject of the Netflix series Monsters.
Eric and I killed our parents together, so I'd say that makes us pretty close. Eric, I know that they would be proud of us.
Well, the men, now both in their 50s, have been in prison ever since that trial. But prosecutors in California have been reviewing their convictions in light of new information. And just in the last few minutes, the Los Angeles County District Attorney has announced that he is recommending the brothers are resentenced, meaning they could soon walk free. Let's just hear a little from DA George Gascon explaining the decision at a press conference.
I believe that they have paid their debt to society and the system provides a vehicle for their case to be reviewed by a parole board. This case will be filed in court tomorrow. The final decision will be made by the judge. Court has to agree with my conclusion that they deserve to be resentenced.
So the district attorney there, let's go straight to LA and join our correspondent, Emma Vardy. Explain more about what's being said and what it all could mean, Emma.
Well, this is a real turning point in the case, and it all hinged on the new evidence which came to light last year. Part of that was a letter written by one of the brothers, which predated the murders, talking about the abuse and referring to the abuse that they later alleged they had been suffering. Of course, at the heart of this, in the trial and several trials that they sat through, was whether they should be believed over the physical and sexual abuse they said they had suffered at the hands of their father. And in the end, that evidence wasn't allowed into the court case in a way that some argue would have been by today's standards. So the emergence of that new evidence last year clearly shone a different light on this, and that led to calls from the family to say they've served their time, they should be released, and arguing that if the aspect of sexual abuse had been taken into account back in the 1980s and 90s in the way it might have been by today's standards, then they would have perhaps had a very different outcome and particularly a different sentencing. So what the DA is essentially saying today in LA is that he is recommending to the court, to the judge, that the murder without parole sentence is removed, effectively then asking for them to be given a lighter sentence. It is a judge's final decision, but it does look much more likely now that they could walk free.
And goodness. And give us a sense of the ramifications of that for such a high profile case. Briefly, Emma.
Well, one of the reasons it gripped the world's attention back in the 90s was that it was televised, and therefore many people around the world watched this, got engaged with the drama and formed their own opinion. And even as far as today, there's been debate as to whether these were victims of abuse or master manipulators, and particularly came even back into the public spotlight because two Netflix series were recently made about the brothers, which each took a slightly different slant on the case. And even their family aren't all on the same page. It's even divided the family as to whether or not they should be released. So a really emotive decision today, a really interesting legal one, when you look at the way that society has moved on in its understanding of physical and sexual abuse when it comes to historic cases like these.
Emma, thank you. Emma Vardy there, live from LA. And That is The World Tonight here on Radio 4 for now. From me, Jane Hill, and everyone on the programme, a very good night.